Hello and welcome to another episode of What Comes Next, a show all about the technologies that will shape your future. I'm Rob Kellner, and as always, I'm joined by Amy Dickens and Kwaku Akpamensa. Amy, Kwaku, how are you doing?
I'm pretty good, man. Yeah, pretty chilled. Looking forward to the episode. This guy is an absolute... Well, if you looked in the dictionary under dude, you would find a picture of our guest today. He's an absolute legend. And yeah, I'm really looking forward to hearing a bit more from him.
Yeah, I think robotics is an area that I'm not super familiar with. I'm a huge fan of sci-fi, so my idea of what a robot is very colored by what I've read. So, you know, I see the Terminator or RoboCop, and I'm very, very excited to hear a little more about somebody who actually works with real robotics.
On this episode of What Comes Next, we're talking to Rich Walker, Managing Director of Shadow Robot Company. With 24 joints, an opposable thumb, and even fingernails, Shadow Robot has developed the most lifelike robot hand in the world today. But why? Why not just make a series of specialized tools like any other robotics company? What is so special about hand? Rich is here to explain. Rich Walker, thank you very much for coming on the show. Can you please describe what Shadow Robot Company does and has built?
Sure. So Shadow is quite a long-running company. We've been around over 20 years. We came together from a team that were working together before that, building robots for fun. It's an unusual start for a business, perhaps, but on the other hand, doing something you enjoy doing basically means that in the quiet times, you've always got something you want to do. So that kind of keeps you motivated. And we started out building hands for robots. Now, that doesn't seem like an obvious thing to do. Why would you build a hand for a robot? Well, the answer is the world around us is designed for people who have four fingers and a thumb on each hand. Everything that we own, everything that we do, everything we interact with is built up around the idea that a human hand is going to interact with it. So if a robot is going to work successfully in the world, we thought, we should put a human hand on it. And then if it can't do something, it's not because it hasn't got the dexterity, it's because you can't program it well enough. Anyway, it turns out that you can't program it well enough, and we spent the last 20 years trying to work out how to solve that problem.
So for people who haven't seen the hand, can you describe how sort of accurate and how lifelike the hand is?
Sure. So it's the best way to describe this. If you imagine a cylinder about the size of an old school coffee can with on top of it a black human hand sticking up vertically, that hand has got the same movements as your fingers and thumb have, a little bit of two movements at the wrist. It's got a kind of flat, black, shiny metal palm and lots of sort of silver where metal parts shine through. It's got fingertips, probably, apparently they're teal, which is a sort of green colour, I call it anyway, but everyone thought it's actually teal. Teal fingertips that give it a sense of touch, and it should have the range of movement that your hand has. So we can use that to do any kind of manipulation, dexterous task that a human would do.
And it's got fingernails as well.
Yeah, fingernails are surprisingly important. They do two things. The first thing is that when you touch something and you slide your finger across it, the vibration against your fingernail helps you understand what it is that you're touching. And the second is...
Wow.
That's so cool.
That's the first knowledge bomb of the day.
Well, and the second, and perhaps even more important, is have you ever tried opening the battery compartment on something?
Without fingernails.
Yeah. And then you get things like picking up a piece of paper from a table. There are two ways to do that. You can use your nails to basically squeeze it and pop it up, or you can slide it over to the edge and pick it up at the edge of the table. So we thought fingernails seemed like a good thing to have on there because the human must have them for a reason. If these were redundant, we'd have evolved them away.
Yeah, fair enough. I never thought about fingernails that way, for sure.
I have a new appreciation for the fingernail now.
And what's the hand's proper name? I want to call it its proper name.
We just call it the hand. It's funny, we've always built components of robots. So we build a part and we don't think of it as a whole. And we've noticed over the years that the first question journalists ask is, what's the name of the robot? And it's like, it doesn't have a name because it's not a conceptual entity. It's not a creature of any sort. It's simply an object. Yes, but what do you call it? Why would I call it anything? Mostly I just swear when it doesn't work.
One of the things that I've sort of wondered at first is that most robots don't resemble living creatures. So planes don't resemble birds, cars don't resemble sort of, you know, anything with four legs. Why is it important? What's the advantage of having something that is, in this case, lifelike?
What you've described is the result of an optimization process. So if you look at some of the first attempts to build planes, they really did try and copy birds.
Yeah.
And that didn't work because getting the power-to-weight ratio right for flapping to work is really, really hard. cars, it's true, don't resemble horses very much, but cars do resemble carriages, which were the things that we put on the back of horses to make moving on wheels work in the first place. With the case of things that we're using hands for, we know that if you know what you're going to do well enough to do it a million times or 100 million times, production engineers can build you an automation solution at that point. But if you're going to do something 10 times and then a different thing and then another different thing, the only thing we know that we have in common for doing that is you are probably going to be able to do it with your hands.
Mm.
So if you're going to do anything, the human hand is currently, if not optimal, at least likely to be able to do them. Once you get to a specific task, then you can build a specific piece of equipment that will do that task. And of course, that will work much better, much more efficiently, much faster, much cheaper at scale in volume for that task. But as soon as you perturb the task slightly, it might fail catastrophically.
So is that then saying that a robotic arm is good with complexity, but across lots of different directions rather than modal productivity?
Yeah, if you look at the way you use a robot arm, literally in a factory, what you do is you say, I've got a task where I want to move something from one place to another, and I don't want to run a guideline or a wire or a rail there. I want to move it through the air from that location to that location. So I take a generic robot arm and I program it with the specific movement I want to do. And a big step forward in production technology was maybe we should be able to program it with more than one movement. So the whole Industry 4.0 is effectively, what happens if we get a robot to do more than one thing? Oh, we can make different things and different versions of things, and we can adapt our production line to change and do differences. Whereas historically what we've done is we've said, let's take these very general purpose machines, and actually they're quite cheap, so it's efficient to use a general purpose machine to do one function over and over again if that function is putting the door on a car.
Right, right. Okay, so please do treat me in absolute layman's terms here, but we're talking about cost savings, or at least one of the things we'll be talking about here, cost savings when you're slightly changing the task again and again and again of what an arm needs to do, a robot hand needs to do.
Yeah, if you built a classic production line, and then you varied what you wanted to do slightly, you'd have to take apart and recommission the entire production line because it was designed with exactly that. If you've seen footage of something like a Coca-Cola bottling plant and you imagine changing the size of the bottles.
Sure, yeah.
That's not going to work. You're going to be months and months and months recalibrating, retuning, tweaking it. But if you've got a machine which has flexibility built in from the ground up, which is what a robot does, then suddenly the possibility that you might change what you're doing within some parameter space becomes an option.
Presumably, when it comes to any kind of activity that is performed with human beings in mind, so I'm now thinking specifically of medical procedures, perhaps, every single one of those is going to be different to some extent. So in order to be able to do the entire procedure, rather than just the uniform elements of it, i.e. stitching up a wound. I'm sure a doctor would tell me that is not the same on every single patient. But if you're going to be able to do an entire procedure, then you're going to encounter unique complexity every single time you do it. And that's, I guess, the exciting thing here.
It may not be complexity, it's just variability. So one of the great successes in surgery has been standardizing surgical procedures so they can be done in almost a production line manner, by using the production line way of thinking. So prepping a patient for surgery, you don't need the surgeon in the room while you're prepping the patient for surgery. The surgeon can turn up right at the point where the first incision needs to be made, or it's not quite, but very, very close to that. If you can get that right, suddenly you can make a surgical process very efficient. If something goes wrong, then all bets are off. Stop what we're doing, cancel my later appointments. I'm going to be dealing with this patient now because what I was expecting to happen hasn't happened, and therefore we're now in a different realm. And the thing that machines are not yet very good at doing is dealing with that, oh, I was expecting this was going to be a very simple task, but it isn't. What do I do? Whereas we expect humans to be able to, if not manage with that, at least react to it and respond to it in what we think of as a sensible way.
So I think the question I'm trying to ask is, how does this hand learn? Because if we can see that it's got a degree of flexibility in what it can actually do, but I'm interested in hearing how it learns.
So at the moment, learning in robots is really hard.
Yeah, I heard.
Know how to teach robots some things. We know how to get robots to work well with certain pieces of variability. So you can make a robot that can move around a factory, a shop floor, reasonably well because you've controlled the amount of variation that's available in that. But as soon as that robot suffers from daylight, it might not be able to navigate anymore because it's relying on lighting levels that are much lower than that, and its sensing becomes confused. If we're trying to teach a task, a skill to a robot that's a complex skill, it's actually really hard still. We're not yet at the point where you can say, and that robot can now sew. Great, let's teach it three different stitches.
Okay.
Instead, we build a machine that can sew and mechanically design it so it can do 10 or 15 different stitches. And then in my world, we give the robot the sewing machine to use because the sewing machine knows how to sew. The robot just needs to know how to put the sewing machine in the right place and do the right things with it.
Okay.
It sounds so the rationale you explained about sort of creating the flexibility sounds like really logical, right? So let's create something with us. So why aren't more people doing this, and why wasn't it sort of done before?
Part of the reason why robotics is such an interesting place to be as a technologist is you never leave the valley of death. As soon as it works, you stop calling it a robot. Self-driving car, not a robot. Drone, not a robot. Autonomous guided tractor, not a robot. Ricardo picking system, not a robot. Go and look at it, and you're like, you've got a whole bunch of robotic engineers in there making that work. Yes, but what we've constructed isn't a robot. We've constructed a system that solved a problem that we had using robotic technology, but now it works. We're labeling it as something else because no one buys a robot. Unless you're actually building a production line, you don't buy a robot. You might buy a welding system that incorporates a robot because you need to do some welding. You might buy a machine tool with a feeder. But a machine tool loader is actually a robot. It's just no one calls it that because all it's doing is loading a machine tool, and that's what you care about. You don't care about the robot bit of it.
So do you think we're still suffering from sort of the sci-fi version of what a robot is, which is essentially a fully like a human being replica wandering around taking over the world? Is that kind of the vision that people have of what a robot is?
Oh, yeah. And don't get me wrong. That's what got us all into doing this in the first place. I mean, basically, people in robotics seem to come from two backgrounds. One lot of us want to make those things, and the other lot got really, really obsessive watching Blue Peter as a child and remember going to the factory tours on play school and going, yeah, I want to make really big and complicated machines that do stuff.
Okay.
But, yeah, robotics is often about we kind of had that vision in our minds, and now we're doing things with that area. And it's very, very hard to shift from thinking, well, are you building data? No, I'm not building data. What I'm trying to build is a holodeck, or I'm trying to build a replicator or a starship or something. I'm not trying to build a humanoid that can operate like a humanoid. The reason I'm building things that are bits of humanoids, components of, is because currently our world is entirely set up around objects that are optimized for our hands to use.
What have you invented? What are the technologies that have made this incredibly sort of dexterous piece of technology possible? Like what is sort of separating you from everyone else out there doing different kinds of end appendages, for lack of a better word?
I would say obstinacy, ignorance, and a complete unwillingness to stare the truth in the face and go, this is really hard, we should do something else. Because honestly, the whole journey through, we've been going, this is a really hard problem, let's try and work out how to solve it, rather than going, do we need to solve this problem? Is there a simpler way of doing it? Let's solve the harder version rather than the simpler version, which kind of got us into a good place in that we'd made something that was significantly different and better in some sense than everything else. You know, any point you can say, yep, it's better on that scale, better on that scale, better on that scale. But equally, it meant that we were designing something that had a didn't have an actual customer in mind. And that, from a commercial point of view, is never a good thing to do. We're very good at something, but nobody wants to pay us for it. That's not an ideal way to run a business. You have no economic engine.
I feel like even though you say there wasn't a customer in mind, it seems like this technology would be applicable across a wide range of markets and a wide range of disciplines. So I almost feel like everyone could potentially be a customer. I don't know if that's helpful, but...
No, that's very true. It's a generalist versus specialist problem.
Yeah.
We have something which you might think of as a cross-cutting generic technology, but it's a technology, TRL 4-5. We have to turn it into an actual product, TRL 7-8, and when you go past TRL 5, you're no longer dealing with the general, you're dealing with the specific. You have to have realistically, you have to have someone who you can pick up on the phone and go, Bill, should it be red or blue?
Right.
Okay. Will you buy more of them if it's red or blue? Thank you.
And sorry, just quickly, what does TRL stand for?
Sorry, TRL is technology readiness level. It's a neat way of thinking about how things develop. It's a scale originally developed by the space agencies. NASA use it. Aerospace people use it a lot. Roughly, you can summarize it as TRL 1 to 3 is... it's in a research lab. No one really knows how to get it to work. Sometimes it works. On a good day, it works. But honestly, if the wind's blowing in the wrong direction, it doesn't work and no one knows why. TRL 4 to 6 is someone's doing it in a spin out. They think they can see where a market is. They're trying to develop some sort of... they're trying to turn it into a technology that they can turn into a product. And then TRL 7 to 9 is the aerospace. We basically think of it as we're actually flying. And to answer the actual question, what's the difference between... me making it and you buying it, and me making it and you not buying it. Great, I'll do one of those rather than the other. If you don't have those people, in some sense, access to somebody who will buy it if you get it right, then all you're doing is science.
Right.
Engineering in the general sense of the word. And the problem with doing science is it's research. And what research does is it takes money and it turns it into ideas and inventions and patents and things. But what we want to do is to take ideas and inventions and patents and things and turn them into money, which is what's generally called innovation.
And do you feel at this point in your journey that you now have that person on the end of the phone who's giving you those demands, or are you still
searching? I have several
searching?
Of them.
Okay.
And that's almost more of the problem because none of them agree. Which is
perfect.
Good from one point of view because it means there are several different places we can get to, mm-hmm. but it's bad because it means you can only use one of them as a touchstone for any one decision, and you have to decide. And you get to the question of going like, well, are we going to be trying to build a thing for there or for there or for there? And which of those three? And okay, we can only do one of them. Which one do we do and how do we make that decision? And sometimes that comes down to a very pragmatic test. You phone them up and you go, Bill, Jim would like me to make it like this. If I do that, it's going to be no use to you. Are you willing to put some money in at this point so I make it like you want it? No? Okay, that's fine. We had the conversation. It was good. You know that it's not going to be useful to you because I'm going to do it for Jim, who's willing to pay me at this point.
So I know that another sort of, I mean, this is one huge area of innovation. Another really interesting area you're looking into is sort of telerobotics. What does that kind of entail and how does that kind of relate to what you're doing right now?
So it's funny, I mentioned the holodeck by in passing. Telerobotics for us comes from two different strands. One is if you've got a robot hand, it's exactly like a human hand. You should be able to put that somewhere that you don't want to put a human hand and get it to do something, whether that's a long way away or whether that's a dangerous place or just somewhere doing a boring or tedious task like on a production line. But the robot hand should be able to go there and do something. If you look at the tools that you want to do that, one of the things you need to do is to be able to track the human hand, measure it, and then see what it's doing in order to get the robot hand to do that. And the tools that do that are all the tools from virtual reality and motion capture and film. So how do you capture the movement of a human and then copy that into a virtual space to do something with it? So where do these two meet? Well, it turns out there's a bunch of people really interested in the idea that you can take what a human does, replicate it into a virtual space, and then propagate that back into the real world again, which is telerobotics. But you do that because you want to give someone an experience that they couldn't have by going somewhere. So we've been working quite closely the last year now with a Japanese airline who have a program called Avatar. I don't know how they deal with James Cameron, but apparently they haven't had that problem yet. And their Avatar program is precisely about using robotics and virtual reality technology to be able to put people in different places so that they can do things there. Mm. Whether that's just sightseeing in a place that you want to go to, but you're never going to get to. Going fishing in a mountain lake where you can't be bothered to make hike up and down there. They're doing some work with ALS patients who are bedbound, operating robots in cafes, working in the cafe, which is just like
it's incredible.
That's amazing.
Yeah. But what they're thinking about is that whole space of, well, how do we put you in another place so you can do something there and it be a real change in the other location?
I mean, it's a fascinating piece of diversification, right? Because an airline is about moving a physical person from A to B.
Yeah.
And this is diversifying into the complete opposite in an interesting way.
Well, they kind of looked at the air travel market is really big, heavy market, lots of money slossing around, lots of capital, lots of turnover, very, very, very thin margins. And they said, I think someone described it to me once as like a flower shop on steroids. This thing, which is a seat, It could sell for $10. It could sell for $10,000. And literally up until the point when you close the gate, you still might sell that empty seat.
Wow.
As soon as you close the gate and no one can get on the plane anymore, all those seats have no more value, but you're still committed to the cost of paying off the cost of having them there in the plane in the air and so on. So the economics of air travel are quite scary. And they were looking at this, and they had one of those great corporate retreats, and they sat down and they were trying to work out what their 100-year roadmap was, vision was going to be. And they originally came up with teleportation.
I'm on board for that.
Yep. I mean, they're in the travel business. They move people from A to B. If we could just eliminate the bit where we sit in a tin can for 8 hours in between, fantastic.
I'm so on board.
So they then fleshed this out. They produced a solid roadmap for doing teleportation.
Oh my God.
What is a solid roadmap for teleportation?
Well, that was the problem.
And when I get one?
It had 8 to 12 Nobel Prizes in it, I reckon. And they said, you know, as a corporation, they've done many things. They were the first people to put televisions on planes. There's some footage from the 1950s, 60s of ANA flights with seat back televisions with little antenna ears. And the stewards would come up during the flight and adjust the ears as they change transmission zones.
That's
awesome. Yeah.
But what they couldn't do was manage Nobel Prizes. I mean, you can't. That's the kind of low TRL innovation that, honestly, business isn't good at. So they kind of backed away from that and said, okay, not teleportation. Is there anything else we can do that's kind of similar? And they realized that telepresence, teleoperation, being in a distant location and doing things, was actually something that was within the set of things they could see how to do, and they could do it on a much shorter time frame.
I'm just immediately starting to think of what the potential industries, the other potential industries are that would look at this, again, coming back to the medical applications of it. But also, I was thinking earlier about, I guess, high-value industries that would be able to put enough money into... is it telerobotics? Is that what it's called?
Telerobotics is when you have a machine at the far end that does stuff. Telepresence is when you just have... So you can buy a telepresence robot today. It's about 4 to 5 foot tall. It's got wheels at the bottom, a thin body, and what probably looks like a big iPad with a camera right at the top. Maybe a couple of goggly eyes or something on it. And it will drive around and you can log into it from your laptop and drive it around in a remote office. It works well for someone who's not in the office today. It doesn't work so well for someone who's never been in the office because nobody's ever socialized with them. So when the screen comes up to them, everyone's like, what's that?
Yeah, sure. So perhaps you could elaborate on other industries that you think this might be a real kind of change for, a real innovation for soon.
I find it very interesting looking at where telepresence, telerobotics can have an effect, because we've had telepresence for a while and it does have an effect. If you fall ill in a remote-ish region in the US and you take yourself to a local clinic, the doctor or the nurse attending might suddenly dial on their phone and hold up their phone to you with a doctor on the end of the phone. And the doctor is at a central clinic somewhere like Mayo and will help manage your condition over the phone. That's telepresence. And you do that because you want to bring specialized expertise in that you don't have on site, and you want to do it straight away. So we already have that working. But where do you want to actually touch things, move things, feel things? Well, as a simple example, if you've ever owned a large piece of machinery that is critical to your business, a milling machine, a power tool or something, when it breaks, and it's when, not if, when it breaks, you phone up the manufacturer and that you say, I've got this service agreement with you, send someone now. And they're like, yep, we'll send someone now. When are they turning up? Well, they're currently in Germany. Then they have to go to Ireland. Then they have to go to Scotland. Then they can come to see you. So what day will they get here? Week Tuesday. And there's nothing you can do. Until that person gets there, you're stuck. If the person could just go, aha, hang on, I'll fire up the robot in the corner of the office, drive over. Okay, take the panel off, poke in some... right, I see what the problem is. This bit here is broken. I can get you one tomorrow morning and we can put that back in and then your machine is working again. That saves you 2 or 3 weeks. That saves them several flights. It makes everyone much happier.
Sure. And I guess the kind of machinery that you're talking about would basically be prevalent in large manufacturing production lines where downtime is going to cost millions for a week, right?
I've had that problem with our milling machine at our company where it's not even that level, but it means you can't do something and you have guarantees. You have deliveries, you have contracts to fulfill, you have people who are waiting for stuff, you have a timeline, a project plan, and suddenly all your plans are disrupted because a critical piece of equipment isn't doing what you expect.
That makes perfect sense. So I'm angling out here is the problem is big enough or expensive enough that a whole industry could be driven from it. So insurance policies, including this type of technology, would very quickly become a more palatable solution and therefore push everyone towards this view of machine maintenance away from the existing types that there are today.
Yeah, that could certainly factor into it. But equally, once you have the ability to put someone remotely, you start doing that for other things as well. If you've got a robot over there that I can drive in and do this, then we can have someone else join this meeting. And they can't be in the room, but they can certainly walk around and pick up your DAS and swap our beers around and rearrange the cables on the table and move and interact with the world around us. If we're sitting here having a design meeting and we're doing a review and here's a product and we're looking at it and we're trying to work out if this product works for us and I want to put my hand inside and feel what's in there, I can do that remotely. But if I can't do that, if I can only look at it with a camera, I'm like, but what happens when I push it? I can't tell. I can't get a feeling for it.
You can imagine that maybe there'd be a situation where you'd have, I don't know, either in an industrial park with multiple businesses on there with some kind of leasing model for that kind of robot, or perhaps one per borough, or in a very affluent neighborhood, you might have lots and lots and lots of these, perhaps a kind of Silicon Valley-esque area for manufacturing where they would have lots of these things available, these robots, sorry, available. I don't know why I apologize there. It is a thing. We've established this earlier. It doesn't have a name. They have more of them available so that the likelihood of significant downtime will be massively decreased. And so essentially what you're saying is in this borough, in this area, business is cheaper to do because downtime is reduced because of the robotic solution provided.
I really like that way of thinking about it, actually. Just like it becomes, as a progressive building landlord, we obviously equipped our building with 16 tele-robots. So that you're, in the same way that we'll have some meeting rooms and we'll have, you know, back in the day, you'd have had really good quality phone booths and maybe you'd have one of those Cisco telepresence meeting rooms with a big screen at the end that you rent out to the people in the office. It's like it becomes an add-on to the building, an add-on to the ecosystem that you lease time on. And I think that's very much why an airline is looking at this, because the business of an airline is to buy very, very expensive equipment and then sell it out in tiny pieces of time to people and provide services on top of that that mean that somebody is willing to pay 10 or 100 times more for a seat at the front than a seat at the back.
I think there's another thing you could attach to that rather than having, you know, a sort of one telerobot per X area is you would tie it to things like a self-driving car or sort of a self-driving drone. And then you would basically have this sort of efficient delivery system whereby a drone would fly in and then drop off a telerobot. The telerobot would do its thing with an expert engineer, mechanic at the other end, fixing the thing, and then it would pick up and fly off. And
it wouldn't even need to be a drone. So there's some really interesting numbers for the way social care is delivered in the UK. And mostly if you are doing social care for councils and you are not working in a care facility at home or something, you're traveling from place to place. So you arrive at someone's house, you are let in or you let yourself in, you do a small piece of care work and then you leave again and you travel to the next place and you spend most of your time going from A to B to C to D to E, which is ridiculously inefficient because it's really hard to get people to do that job because it's actually physically brutal and unpleasant work to do. It's very fulfilling and rewarding, but it's really just it's lifting people up, moving people around, cleaning things. It's hard work. And if you couple that with having to get around from job to job, it has a really, really high churn rate. So if instead of that you had, well, there's a bunch of council-owned tele-robots that can just sort of get themselves from one place to another by whatever means, walk, climb, crawl, drive, get the bus, we don't mind. But as long as they get there and then the robot knocks on the door, gets let in, the person now connects to it and can do the task and can spend a lot longer doing it because they're not spending their time traveling from job to job.
What I'm envisioning here is almost like what the computer became, which is it was originally kind of business level item and then it became in every household. It was a very personal thing. And this almost sounds like something that would be really exciting to have in every home. So if you're, you know, if you're needing like a plumber or an electrician or a carer or anything like that, it's almost like someone can sort of plug in and am I extrapolating far into the future?
I'm just thinking about that as suddenly we got back to building ourselves a robot butler. But yeah. We're avoiding the whole software problem. Because one of the problems with the, sure. the robot that does everything is programming it and making that programming reliable and safe and making it cope with all the complications of human life. If what you're actually doing is providing a means for a person to remotely connect to somewhere to do something, then suddenly you can eliminate a lot of that complexity.
Well, that's what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you've got one of these in every household and then, yeah, that person can connect into your specific robot, do the work and then log out. I mean, that's kind of exciting.
So one of the things that NA are thinking about is doing the other way around, Tokyo 2020, right? It's going to be quite crowded. Getting to Japan is a fair effort of time, and you know it's not cheap to do. A lot of people aren't going to go to the Olympics because they just can't face the cost, expense, time, the commitment, and so on. What about logging in remotely?
And this so
competing remotely,
and this ties into the other, I guess, part of the, I don't know if it's telepresence or telerobotics, which side of the fence it fits on, but the sort of the physical feedback, the haptic feedback, I guess it's fair to say, of, in other words, communicating physical sensation from one place to another. It's a really interesting area, and I know that that's part of kind of what you're doing as well. Sort of kind of how is that developing, and how close are we to sort of experiencing things in that sort of, you know, other dimension?
So getting the sense of touch is, for me, it's a bit that differentiates it from being, you know, a face on wheels moving around that can shout at you and ask you to do things and talk to you and maybe interact successfully, but it can't give you a hug. It can't pick something up off the floor. It can't go, no, flick that switch, push dead like that, or put that cable in that socket. And to give it a sense of touch has really been the bigger challenge. We've been able to build robots that you can operate remotely since 1950s, I think the first ones around. They weren't very capable, but they were definitely being operated remotely over distances for things like nuclear operations, where you're working with really radioactive stuff. Mm. You have a machine in there, you control it from out of here using joysticks because you can't go in there. Mm. But what we actually want to do, interesting things, is to have that sense that we are there, that sense of immersion. Mm. So VR headsets, 3D vision systems, those start to give you a sense of immersion. But it's really interesting that if you can see, you're sort of there. But if you can feel, there's a much deeper and more immediate connection with the other place. Mm. And part of what we've been doing in the last couple of years has been working with some very capable tools on both parts of that. Touch sensors that give the robot a really good sense of touch. And then haptic devices, so things that go over your fingertips that basically make you feel like you're feeling the thing that the robot is feeling. Or at least something that your brain interprets as being what the robot is feeling. And that change has meant that we can do things that previously would have been effectively impossible, like picking up delicate objects, or we do a demo where we stack cups. Sounds really easy. They're soft plastic cups. Mm. And you start with one stack of them and drop them one by one into a sort of 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 tower. And to do that, you have to be able to feel quite a small difference between I'm squeezing this stack so hard all the cups stay together and I've loosened it so one falls out the bottom. It's a trivial task, but it's what we can now do.
Wow, so that's the level of dexterity that you've gotten to there. What's the most dexterous movement that one of these robot hands can do at the moment?
The robots can do more than we can control still. So we still have the problem that it's a case of sort of at each step you lose some precision and sensitivity. So you have a very, very precise robot, but then your control software is a bit less precise, and then your transmission system is a little bit less precise, and then the thing at the other end that you're using to measure the person is a bit less precise again. And each of those just, what the automotive engineers call the tolerance stack, that just builds up. And at some point you run into, yeah, the whole tolerance stack means we can only do things this capably, but we know what to adjust and tune to improve that. So if we stop doing it halfway around the world, we can be a lot more precise. If we have a better vision system, you can be more precise because you can see it. If you change the speed, sometimes that helps. Getting better senses of touch and better haptic rendering, as we call it, back to the person, that's the differentiator that really should make it possible to thread a needle with a piece of thread, for example, which we still haven't done remotely.
So haptics, haptic rendering, I'm definitely going to be using that around the dinner table.
Common
near
phrase.
Me soon.
Yeah.
Is that the industry that's currently playing catch up?
Well, it's interesting that it's jumped forward quite a lot recently just because people said, well, hang on, all the VR stuff over here works. We've seen what people have done with games controllers, game interfaces. We've seen the kind of feedback that your phone or your watch can give you, where it can give you quite complex information by means of vibrating, shaking, twisting, making a feeling in your hand. Why haven't we got a bit further with the what can we do with starting with the virtual space? And that's changed. And certainly where I work, it's often in the area where a whole set of things exist at a certain level and you can't really do anything yet. And then one of them moves forward a little bit, another one moves forward a little bit, and a relatively small change suddenly means that everything moves forward quite a lot.
Can you give an example of that?
Well, this is the case with haptics. But if you think about phones and phone communications and network communications, so there's a whole bunch of 1990s internet business plans that involve being able to do online shopping, where you'd be able to look at an object in 3D and rotate it around and see it from various views and walk through it. And of course, you couldn't do those over a 33K modem. So those business plans fail completely. Now, I can do that on my phone. Of course, I can, you know, open something on eBay, scroll through it, click on a link somewhere, and, oh, I've got now a 3D view. I'm actually scrolling around the object, and I'm doing it over a 4G phone connection. And I'm not even thinking about the amount of data I'm using because I've got an inclusive data package. So it's not relevant that I just pulled down 200 megabytes of data to make that work because I don't care. It's just, the things have got good enough.
So following that timeline that you've just looked back into there and essentially how much we're taking for granted on a day-to-day. Let's look forward and think about what a company analogous to Shadow Robot might be looking at in, let's say, 10 years' time from now.
Hopefully we'll have planted a lot of trees.
Awesome. I'm glad you said that because I see a lot of Boston Dynamics, is it? The military guys. Yeah. That seems to be the face of robotics and how the public sees them. And it's really nice to hear somebody who actually works in the industry saying something that I would consider to be aspirational.
Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, we've always been doing this because we felt that it was possible by building robots to do something that wasn't just interesting, but was kind of in some sense worth doing. And we've looked at various areas where we thought that was possible, and it turned out it wasn't. Now, for planting trees, it might well be that we build a robot to plant trees. Actually, it probably looks like it's much more sensible to use drones to scatter seeds widely across land and just do that well. And actually, the agri-tech people are really, really good now at doing soil surveying from height and going like, yeah, if we put those things there and those things there. And I can kind of imagine that in 10 years' time, we will have reforested areas with drones that very tactically planted the right shoots in the right places to get a really good yield out of that.
I really, really hope that's the case.
From our side, we've kind of looked at a few other areas. At the moment, we're focusing on a challenge of the other sort, a negative challenge. So reforesting is in some ways positive. If you do that, the world gets obviously better. You've made it nicer. You've made it better. You've done some good. It's clear how that works and why that works. But there are other problems where it's like, there's a big fat negative. We have to deal with that negative. How bad is that negative? So if I said to you that as a UK taxpayer, you're going to be responsible for part of a £250 billion cost over the next 40 years, and we're going to spend that money in the UK. And we're not going to spend that making anything nice. We're not going to build any nice, shiny new buildings. We're not going to create any schools or hospitals with that money. We're going to use that hospital cleaning up a massive, great mess. Can we not do it? No, we have to do it. Okay, so we're going to spend the money doing that. So as a technologist, what could I do usefully there? Well, could you make it quicker, cheaper, faster, or safer? Well, if I can't, I should probably be handing my hat in. So that's what we're looking at. Now, the one I'm referring to there is clean up after nuclear power. And in the UK, we have some very old bits and pieces from that, in the 1940s and 1950s up in Cumberland. And we have lots of power plants at the moment that we're still thinking about building or building. And we're going to have a lot of waste. That waste is going to be around. We're going to have old buildings that have become contaminated. We have to clean those up. We have to remove that. We have to decontaminate it. And the estimated cost at the moment is around £250 billion. That's a lot of schools and that's a lot of hospitals. So if we can save 1% on that, that's still quite a few schools and hospitals.
Absolutely. And yeah, that's a kind of sobering thought. Do you think that others in this industry are thinking about this in a similar way to you? Or do you think that Shadow Robot Company has a quite kind of unique view of this? And I'll add to this slightly as well, because it strikes me that you guys might be a slightly alternative company within this sphere. Would that be fair to say?
we may be coming at this from a slightly different position. So we are structurally different to most companies in that we're employee owned. We've been around for a long time. We have no primary shareholders big enough to set the decision of the company by themselves. Instead, we tend to work out what we're doing by a variation on collective decision making. We have, you know, strategy meetings, develop our own roadmaps, think about what we're going to do and why, and kind of sanity check that with everybody in the company. And sometimes we turn business down on ethical grounds. We take a look at something and we just turn around and say, yeah, sorry, that doesn't pass ethical review. We're not going to do that. And other people say, but there's good money to be made there. So, yes, but we don't think it's good money. We just think it's money. And we'd rather make less money that was good money than more money that wasn't good money, because when it comes down to it, we have to motivate ourselves to come in and do this every day. If we're only coming in for the money, well, we should be doing something else.
That's awesome. Fair play to you. Yeah.
It's really refreshing to hear of a company that's dealing with technology in an ethical way. That makes me very happy to hear. But it seems very poetic to me that your ultimate goal, and maybe this is me extrapolating what your ultimate goal is, but the traditional view, as we mentioned earlier, on robots is that they're kind of cold and inhuman, and you know, you get the kind of science fiction version where they're taking over the world and they're destroying things. But it seems to me like you're aiming to make them, like you talk about touch and you talk about connection, which is a really innately human thing, and I just think that's quite poetic.
I almost wonder if it's a difference in thinking from a design point of view rather than from an engineering point of view.
Maybe.
I don't know if you know the old joke that most mad science is actually mad engineering.
Let's build
a giant robot to terrorize a city. That's not science. That's definitely engineering. Right? And we're kind of like, yeah, let's not build a giant robot to terrorize a city. If we built a giant robot, what could we do with it that would be nice? What would be fun? What would be interesting? What would be something worth doing with a giant robot? Maybe it would be terrorizing a city. I don't know. But, you know, let's start from the point of view that we're not just trying to be the bad guys. And yeah, when you start thinking about that, you do start thinking about wider consequences and triple bottom line and being things like B Corps and thinking about your organization as, are we building something because we just want to make a lot of money, or are we building something because we want to create something of value both to ourselves and to a wider community? And maybe that's what means that we end up thinking about those problems rather than the let's build another great big shiny machine.
You mentioned earlier the sort of fascinating idea about teach it so that you've got this incredibly kind of dexterous, flexible kind of piece of technology. But obviously part of it is teaching it or creating a system whereby it adapts to its different environments to do different things. And I know you have you're in partnership with OpenAI to sort of accomplish some of that.
So what's interesting about our customers is that the people who buy hands for robots, and remember, we're talking about hands that are definitely for robots, not for human beings. This isn't prosthetics. So the people who are buying that are trying to work out how to get a robot to do something. Now, either they're people doing actual research in robotics, creating new algorithms and doing things with so many equations on the page that I, as an ex-mathematician, just look at it and go, yes, thank you, professor. I'll let one of my technical people read that because I don't understand that anymore. Or they're people who are trying to effectively to crack the mystery of AI, crack the mystery of intelligence, build things that have some part of human-like thinking embodied in them. And to do that, they've made things that can play Tetris. They've made things that can play catch the flag games. They can play Starship Fighting Empire games. Great. They can play Go. Great. But they can't pick up a cup and give it to you. And they certainly can't learn through that from scratch. So that's what's been interesting about working with OpenAI has been they've explicitly said, we want to teach a robot hand how to do something as a way of showing that our AI system is capable of learning to act in the real world. And that's given us a really interesting driver because the way they break our robots is very different to the way everyone else breaks our robots. All of our customers break robots because it's what you do. You're using them in new and interesting ways and you find the edge and something breaks eventually, kind of a given. But what they're doing is learning to pick things up and handle them in a way that's perhaps similar to the way a child learns, but without the softness and flexibility that a child has. So they really burn through robots.
I'm immediately thinking about how you could teach a robot to do different tasks in different physical environments. Mm. So zero gravity.
Space.
Yeah.
Underwater.
Or Worsley to space.
Yeah,
on
exactly.
Mars.
Or Worsley to space.
We've done some work with several space agencies now, which is kind of nice. We've got a little checklist. We've got that one. We've got that one. We've got that one. and in fact, one of our first customer sales was to a space agency. The UK government has quite a nice program about overseas trade and investment. They put funding in to help businesses go abroad and meet people who they might do business with in a kind of sensible, tactical way. So we were on that program and we said, there's this workshop over here in the US where there's a bunch of people from the space community and others talking about grasping and manipulation. We think we should go to that, but we can't afford to. And what was then UK Trade and Investment said, well, you know, here's a couple of hundred, 500 quid, go and see what happens. And we came back and we said, turns out NASA are really interested in buying one of these.
Awesome.
And we ended up selling hardware to NASA. So that was back around 2005, 2006.
That's a good day.
That's a pretty big name to have on your client book.
And we did some other work with the European Space Agency. Now, they were looking at something more in the kind of telerobotics area. How do you put a robot somewhere and remotely operate it?
Yeah.
Whereas NASA are actually looking at what they call, and are still working on, a program called Robonaut, which is almost exactly the kind of classic upper body humanoid that can do things and is intelligent and does them by itself. We've also had some interest from the Japanese Space Agency, JAXA. And we haven't yet worked out exactly what it is they want to do, but they have tried various things like hardware and gone, this is really interesting. Next budget cycle, we will be investing. So we look forward to finding out what exactly they're planning with that.
So will Shadow Robot be on Mars?
It's a long way away. And the field service calls are really, really terrible.
I hear that's a problem.
I've got a queue of engineers going like, if we do the International Space Station and it needs fixing, I'm going.
It's got the idea of like two robots in a rocket fixing each other along the way.
Eventually sci-fi romance going.
Exactly.
Yeah. One of my colleagues who does a lot of our robot fixing is also an artist, and he has done a kind of version of the Escher drawing.
With
the two robot hands fixing each other.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that, we talk a bit about sort of robotics, but I want to just kind of frame this in something that's really happened. So you had people stacking cups, and the actual user was in San Francisco, and the cups were in London.
We've done it from San Francisco to London. We've done it from London to Tokyo. We're doing it quite regularly now between West Coast US and London, because effectively our development team is split across that. And it's quite a nice motivating use case for doing this. It's like half the team's over there and half the team's over there, and the sponsors. Great thing about being an international organization is we're based, core team's in London, we're working with a team over in San Francisco, and we're working with a team in Tokyo. And that means that it's possible to have a meeting every 8 hours, and it's really late for someone, and it's really late for someone else, really early for someone else, and it's in the middle of the day for the third one. And you just kind of swap round and swap round and swap round, just kind of with somebody always being like, I really need to go to sleep now. And someone else being like, I need coffee.
This is like team building of the future. I love this idea.
Yeah. Just the idea that that someone on one side of the planet can pick up a glass in the other side of the planet. I think that's exactly the kind of innovation that 90% of the population won't actually know exists yet. And it's this huge thing here, right? The implications of that are absolutely massive. So really, really cool to hear what the potential of that is.
I guess the question is, can they also pour the champagne?
Exactly.
I really wanted to do that. We were, we did a piece in Vegas for Amazon's Remars conference, and I was going, can we do a champagne tower? Please, can we do a champagne tower? Stack up the glasses and then pour the champagne on the top. And eventually everyone said to us, you can do it under two conditions. Number one, when the champagne bottle goes pop, you fix the robot when it breaks. And number two, you pay the cleaning bill for the hotel. And I was like, it's a casino, right? Yes. Pay the cleaning bill in a casino. No.
Cancelled.
Rich, so if people want to keep up with Shadow Robot Company, where should they go?
So our website, www.shadowrobot.com, has all the up-to-date information, or tag us obviously and follow us on LinkedIn.
Rich Walker, thank you very much for coming on.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Does anyone know why? I should have asked this. Why is it called Shadow Robot Company?
I guess because you've got, that's the telepresence thing, right? Telerobotics. I've learned that today, because you have the shadow of movement that's going on. So I guess that's why they've done that.
The shadow of a person.
Shadow of a person.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, it could be that. Yeah, for sure.
something that I didn't get to mention during the interview is that the International Labour Organization says that 250,000 people a year die working in like dangerous environments. And I think the majority, I think about half of those people, it's just through exposure to asbestos. Like, this is the kind of technology that could save literally hundreds of thousands of lives. And if that isn't a reason to, if that isn't like a benefit of innovation, I don't know what is. Incredible.
Yeah, it's I guess the flip side of what's often quite a kind of negative discussion around automation and losing jobs. It's like there are some jobs that we would really, really like to lose because nobody wants to put their lives in danger if we can help it. So yeah, that's a really interesting stat.
This makes me think of the recent television series, the Chernobyl series. And there's an episode in there where they're actually sending a robot onto a rooftop to clear rubble from the top of the reactor. And it made me feel ill watching it because I know that this is a dramatized version and I know that this is potentially not what actually happened. But just the thought of like real humans having to be faced with that, knowing that it's probably going to end up in their death. And they actually do try a robot and of course it doesn't work. And so just the implications of this technology being able to take on tasks like that, or, you know, in the deep sea or in space. I always bring it back to space. Yeah, I just think it's phenomenal and I really want to see them do well.
And I was thinking about Chernobyl a lot too when he was talking, and there's that scene, right, where the robots fail and so they decide to use bio-robots, which is just people, like thousands and thousands of people that have been exposed to this horrendously dangerous amount of radiation. And like this is actually the kind of technology that could kind of solve these problems. And you know, like you were saying, there is a huge issue with kind of nuclear decommissioning, not just in the UK, obviously, but just around the world. This is going to be a real issue. And again, this is the kind of technology that could really do some good there.
And even in the less sort of drastically dangerous jobs, he mentioned carers and that they have to lift quite heavy weights because they're moving people around and they're having to do quite physical jobs in addition to doing quite emotionally draining jobs as well. So just the application of this technology for that, I mean, it's not quite as dramatic as clearing nuclear waste, but it would be a huge improvement to the careers of these people and also to the people that they're helping.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of What Comes Next. Make sure you don't miss an episode by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts. If you have any questions about anything we've discussed on today's show, or any comments, or would like to share your own game-changing innovation on What Comes Next, then drop us an email. We're at wcn@rantree.co.uk. Thank you very much again, and see you next time.